This is an audio recording taken from the Daru Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum held on the 5th of June 2014 at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre.
I'm now going to hand over to Sarah Fortas, who is the Policy Manager at NDIS, and she'll be talking to us about the NDIS. Over to you, Sarah.
Hello everyone. I'm from National Disability Services, which is the peak body for disability services in Australia. And what I'm going to do today is briefly give a bit of just a background about NDIS and talk a bit about where we are. We're 11 months in now for our trial site down in Barwon, and then sort of touch on perhaps some of the safeguarding examples. As I think people are aware, I'll just run through some of the basics. Okay, so NDIS, it's a tax-funded insurance scheme shifting from a welfare to an insurance basis. And it's going to be a nationally consistent scheme with that focus on individualised funding, individual packages, and also a focus on early intervention, that investment upfront, reflecting insurance emphasis. It represents a really significant investment in disability, which is just so fantastic. And when the whole thing rolls out by 2019, it'll increase the investment to $22 billion a year, a significant increase on what we're on now. And as we know, in the recent federal budget, NDIS emerged unscathed. I think there'll be more of a question about funding in sort of 2 or 3 years' time. That's when the Commonwealth will actually need to begin chipping in some more dollars. So I think everyone here would know why we need a totally new disability system. As the Productivity Commission found, our existing one, it's not only inequitable and underfunded, it's really not delivered the kind of outcomes we want in this kind of society. If we look at the employment statistics for people with disabilities, they're really atrocious, way down on the OECD average. And so many people with disability live in poverty. We also have, 8 different systems. This is actually a slide from the NDIA, and they talk about the three key pillars which underpin the design of NDIS. There's that insurance approach, which I mentioned, a real emphasis on choice and control, and I suppose balancing that against their other kind of languages, reasonable and necessary. But the choice and control is reflected in the individual packages and the focus on working with individual participants rather than funding service providers. The whole thing is also set up with an expectation that the mainstream will step up and provide good, appropriate, inclusive services to people with disability. So it's a real paradigm shift, and that shift of power. And it's also based on the idea of creating a more competitive disability market with the aims of being more efficient and giving people much more choice and stimulating innovation. So it's a real belief in the market system and the potential of what that can deliver. But it's going to be a market with limits because we know that a free market cannot be created in all areas for people with disabilities. There's going to be some geographic areas where there'll need to be, where they call it the thin market, where the government will need to provide some additional supports or encouragement to make sure that services are available. So as we know, the NDIS is rolling out in a staged approach. To date, we've had 4 trial sites, obviously in Barwon, as well as in the Hunter, Tasmania and South Australia, and they've all got differences in their focus and the way they're being rolled out, and that's to get some real lessons, you know, what works better. And now we've also, from July, the whole of the ACT will be transitioning across, and the Barkly region in the Northern Territory, which is a predominantly Indigenous and remote community. So that's going to pose some very interesting challenges for this new system. Now, just talk about sort of 10, 11 months in, what we're finding. And I suppose it's been, wow, sort of a roller coaster ride for many of our members. It's been pretty challenging, very stressful. And I think everyone involved, participants, families, service providers, and certainly agency staff, have all found a very sort of challenging and very busy time. But people can be pleased that there's a lot of good anecdotal evidence around now of people getting some terrific packages. People who haven't received packages for, you know, funding for years for equipment have now received it. They've got rid of the waiting lists for the ISPs and in children's services. There's been a huge growth in the number of registered providers down in Barwon, over 400 now. And, you know, so there's been lots of growth and simulation. There's also been recognition that it's a real challenge, and people haven't always had the capacity to take that up and make the most of it in these first few months. Some of these early problems have related, one's been around pricing, which from our perspective is a key one. Because the price for one-to-one supports is very low, it's really putting the pressure on and not really allowing things like supervision and training and travel between people. And anyway, so there's a real issue around the price, some of the prices, not all of the prices. Early on, there were concerns around the planning processes, but they're kind of getting sorted. The NDIA is listening and engaging with a broader array of people, and that seems to be better. There were, rather predictably, lots of issues with the IT portal that's used by the agency. And I think the pace, it's just been this full-on implementation. And in Victoria, as compared to the other state or the other trial sites, they had this really challenging timetable to transition just about everyone across from existing programs in the first sort of 10 or 11 months of the trial. So there's been this huge pressure just to transition people across. But that's actually now progressing well, and soon it will mean that the agency can move into what they're calling a business as usual mode, where they can get on and begin just, you know, take a breath and support participants, begin perhaps undertaking reviews to check their packages are appropriate, and also undertaking some of that community engagement, which has really perhaps got a bit lost in the rush to get people across. In terms of sort of concerns that are around, let's run through a few of those. We're doing some work around the need for block funding of some activities and programs. That's things like advocacy, information and advice, volunteer coordination. There's a whole lot of really valuable activities which are poorly suited to individualised funding. And we believe that the NDIA should be funding them on a block funding basis. And we've just been working on a paper about that, working with Carers Australia and the Association of People with Disabilities sort of nationally, to see if we can jointly put together an argument that these types of services need to be funded and put that to the NDIA. There's also some growing concern at the moment about the people who are ineligible for the NDIS. We know that it's always only going to cover a certain proportion of people with disabilities. There's a lot of other people who rely on different services. Some of those services have gone across and their funding's gone across to NDIA. Some still funded by the state government. We want to make sure those services remain. So we need to keep up the lobbying around that. further challenges, which you wouldn't be surprised about, that I think as a whole sector we're going to face is around workforce. Perhaps a doubling of the sector is going to put a great demand for workers. The prices of NDIA are based on sort of award, minimum award, you know, conditions. Where are we going to find sufficient workers and good workers coming years? I think we all know about the shortage of housing, and many people are coming with expectations that this is going to address their dire housing needs. Where is that capital going to come from? And there's also issues around developing a market, making sure that so there aren't unintended consequences from a more competitive market-driven environment. So, from our perspective, in the context of all this pace of change and further changes as the whole thing will roll out in 2016 to 19 in Victoria, we're out all the time encouraging our members to get ready, NDIS ready, and doing a lot of work with organisations to get them to really look at their strategic planning, their direction, their costs, their efficiency, their service models, marketing, the whole lot. There's a huge amount of work to be done to be prepared for a more competitive market. We're also recognising the need to work together cross-sector to sort out some of these teething issues, some of the issues that are naturally coming up, because it's such a huge new system. There's many, many issues, and by working together we're able to sort them out, we're hoping now during this trial period, so that by the time it rolls out some of those will have been resolved, we'll have worked out what's the best way forward. We also need to work together to keep the pressure on governments, state and federal, to fund the Tier 2. Those people are not eligible for NDIS. We need to keep up the pressure on that NDIS doesn't solve everything for disability. That's what we sometimes hear. Oh, no, it's off the agenda. Disability is off the agenda. We've got NDIS. That's not correct. We really need to make sure that the state government stays in there, stays engaged, and supports the mainstream services in stepping up and playing their role to achieve, you know, the aims of the disability strategy and our state plan. And one example I want to mention in terms of that kind of working together is a recent project that NDS has been running called Zero Tolerance, around preventing and responding to abuse and neglect of people with disability in non-government services. And so this has been a project that we've been undertaking in consultation with service providers, academics to get the sort of the research best practice, and focus groups with people with disabilities across the country, pulling together an evidence-based framework with practical tools and resources, and also feeding this into some of the safeguarding work that the NDIA is looking at. Out of that document, there's a report, there's a longer version I've left out the front, and then some easy English versions of the Speaking Up About Safety report. And that, I suppose that's sort of touching on the safeguards, and we're keen to keep working jointly to do some things like that to help make this future a much better system. Thank you. We go to Lauren and then questions. We do Lauren and then questions, or yes.
Lauren, are you happy to speak from the table there, or would you like to...
I might come up.
Oh, okay, all right then, fabulous. Our next speaker, and thank you very much, Sarah, our next speaker is Lauren Matthews, the Executive Officer from the Early Childhood Intervention Australia, and please join me in welcoming Lauren to the podium.
I'll just get the technology working.
Yep.
Beautiful. First off, just to acknowledge the traditional owners on the land in which we're meeting today and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Many of you I know because I've worked with you in one of the many hats that I have worn over the years on my journey to get to this point. I used to work for the Association for Children with a Disability and also for VCOS, so worked very closely with Natasha and then Sharon at Daru. So I've been around a while, so if many of you are thinking, I know that girl, that's probably where you know me from. Thank you for having me here today. I think the Daru advocacy sector conversations are so exciting that Robin and Natasha have started having these. It's a great opportunity for the sector to come together and really talk about some of the key issues. And today I'm going to talk to you a little bit around the context of safeguarding the rights of people with disabilities from the perspective of the NDIS trial sites, and in particular how we can engage and respond to the needs of particularly vulnerable people as we go forward in the NDIS. Also, just to note a little disclaimer that this presentation is my interpretation of the situation and the policy. It's not official advice and I'm certainly not speaking on behalf of the NDIA. I'm just here to provide you with our perspective and also bear in mind that the NDIS changes all of the time. So the presentations that Sarah and I would give you today will be very different to the presentations that we'd probably give you next week. So it's certainly a roller coaster ride. So this is a bit of a snapshot at a point in time. This is just a little bit about who we are. We're the peak body for early childhood intervention in Victoria, and three issues are at the core of our work at IKEA. One is, of course, the NDIS, and particularly the impact that it will have on young children with disability and developmental delay, along with their families. The second is the state-funded early childhood intervention services system. We cover early childhood intervention services, kindergarten inclusion support, and also the preschool field officer program. And the third thing that we really focus on is the inclusion of children with disability and developmental delay in universal settings, so in particular early childhood education and care and also the transition to school. Collaboration is really key for us and we work closely with our colleagues in the other states, with other peak bodies such as National Disability Services and VicServe, statewide organisations like Daru and the Association for Children with a Disability, government and also our individual members and organisations. In times of rapid change like this, by working together is really the only way that our voice can be heard and we can continue to have impact and influence. We're also Victorian government funded as a peak body as well. That's just a little bit about what we do, the usual kind of peak body stuff, but really it's all undertaken with the ultimate aim of positive outcomes for children, families, professionals and organisations. Just a little snapshot about what early childhood intervention is now. It really is the process of providing a range of supports and services that promote development, wellbeing and participation in the community for young children with developmental delays or disability and their families. It's really about supporting families to help children develop skills and abilities, to participate in everyday life, to understand the types of experiences that can assist in growth and development, and really provide people with a vehicle to enjoy their children and their family. We also have found in early childhood intervention through evidence that children learn most in everyday learning environments with familiar people. So the focus of early childhood intervention today is really about supporting everyday learning and will naturally build on opportunities. So it's often provided in natural environments, and that's certainly the model that we were able to get funded in the National Disability Insurance Scheme. For us, we're one of the few areas in the NDIS that got a much higher price than we already had in terms of our funding. So in Victoria, we're currently funded $7,385 per early childhood intervention place. And under the NDIS, there's now a $16,000 benchmark for the same service. So for us, that's incredibly exciting that for those children that require more service, we're actually able to get funded for that. And that's certainly an example of powerful advocacy between our organisation and also our colleagues in the other peak bodies and also with the Victorian government as well. It also helped that we had a significant body of evidence that we were able to use to influence those policy decisions. So that's why it's great that you guys are launching a report today on looking at the evidence base that you have and looking at how you're using data to really illustrate a picture of the advocacy sector. We have a number of roles. in the NDIS, certainly as a peak body supporting our members in Barwon and also supporting our members as we look to the statewide rollout of the NDIS. We provide information and advice. Sometimes I'm sure they would argue I tend to provide them with too much advice on to state and territory jurisdictions and also with the NDIA on the perspectives of early childhood intervention. We're also funded by the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development in Barwon to provide support to our member organisations there as we move to the NDIS. So some things we work on are the in-kind, so that's really how we deal with the funding transfer from the state to the NDIA. And also we've been doing a lot of training with the Association for Children with a Disability on supporting families with young children in making the transition to the NDIS, and in particular in those sessions really focusing on how to support people develop their plan for their child and think about their goals. I think it's very naive to assume that people, particularly in early childhood where they're dealing just with the fact of having a new baby or a young child, to then expect them to know what goals they want to achieve in the future. That's a pretty big expectation. So we're delivering a lot of services and support through ACD to really be able to help families on that journey and really engage in putting together the best quality services for them and their child. I also deliver support across Australia in all of the trial sites that are delivering early childhood intervention. So if you have any questions about what it's looking like in other sites, I'm there on the ground pretty frequently. So we're working in Barwon and Hunter. Both of them are looking at children from birth, people from birth to 65. And in South Australia, where they're focusing predominantly on children in their launch site. Also supporting Western Australia and the ACT, who are coming on board, and their launch sites will include children as well. And we also do a lot of information analysis and dissemination. I think in terms of responding to the needs of vulnerable people, in particular in the NDIS, it's really about making sure that no one misses out or falls through the cracks. You as disability advocates are constantly aware of the people that are falling through the cracks, and you're there to stand alongside them on their journey to really help them navigate the system. But I think for us, we had a number of concerns about engaging particularly vulnerable families in the National Disability Insurance Scheme. I think the concept of self-referral is fantastic for those people that have the confidence and ability to engage with a provider. For us, with young families, we'd had a system where it was a mixture of self-referral and also third-party referral, and that really meant that we could capture those families that may not have the capacity to engage with the system. So we were noticing in the beginning of the NDIS, with the predominant focus on self-referral, particularly in Barwon, that we weren't seeing the kind of numbers of young children presenting to be clients of the NDIA. Traditionally, we would have had about 30 young children a month go onto the waiting list in Barwon to access early childhood intervention services, and we certainly weren't seeing that number of people approaching the NDIA for service. So our members got together, along with the NDIA, with ourselves and with the Victorian government, and we thought, well, how can we fix this problem? How can we make sure that vulnerable families, you know, such as those who might be connected to drug and alcohol services, or those engaging in child protection, those experiencing poverty and disadvantage, or those that are just at such a point of grief and loss on their journey that they don't have the capacity to engage with the system, how can we make sure that they can be part of this and actually get access to the services that they need? So we spent a lot of time really thinking about self-referral and the challenges for young families, and now there's some tools that have been developed that allow third-party referrals into the NDIS. So maternal and child health, kindergarten teachers, GPs, paediatricians, community health, they're all now using a new form for referral, which means that as long as they get the consent of the family, they refer into the NDIA, and then the NDIA is able to engage with that family, which means that we know where people are and we know that they're existing if they're engaging with universal services. So that's really great for us to be able to have that win, and that's rolling out nationwide. So that's really exciting that we can build up that engagement in the NDIS. I think the complexity of the system is a real challenge in when we think about making sure no one falls through the cracks. And I think that's why we really need a strong advocacy sector in the NDIS to be able to support people so that they don't get lost because the system is too hard to understand. They might not have high literacy levels. They may not speak English. They may be experiencing extreme poverty. So we need to make sure that those safeguards are in place so nobody misses out. I think it's also the common misconception that the NDIS is the panacea for everything we've been looking for over the years for disability services and generally around inclusion in community. Unfortunately, it is not. The NDIS is an insurer, and we need to remember that. I think it's about how do we make sure that universal services have the capacity to deal with inclusion, and they're actually doing that in a meaningful way, both from a human rights perspective, but also in terms of the long-term economic benefit that that will generate. I think we run the risk with a focus on the NDIS and individual choice and control that mainstream services will see this as an opportunity to say disability is somebody else's problem. They've already done a pretty good, they've already had a pretty good effort at doing that anyway. So we run the risk of that becoming more, I think, explicit unless we're really strong with the NDIA and with all levels of government, that if we actually had inclusive mainstream services, we probably wouldn't need to spend so much money on some of the specialist supports that we're engaging in. I think in terms of early intervention, I know if we had every preschool program or every childcare centre had confident and competent teachers in inclusion, we probably wouldn't need to be delivering as much early intervention as we currently do. It's also about how we make sure that the other parts of the service system are connected in with what the NDIS is about, and that they're able to engage people on that journey as well. I think about drug and alcohol, child protection and justice services. They have a crucial role to play, as do education, in making sure that people are connected and engaged. And I think we need to make sure that the excitement of the NDIS doesn't mean that we lose our focus in improving those broader systems. I think as well we have the issue of ineligible clients. For young children, eligibility is less of a problem because there is an early intervention component in the legislation, which means that any child with a disability or developmental delay is eligible for the NDIS. So that was a great win for us to have developmental delay included. It was a big fight, and many jurisdictions were certainly pretty mad that we were able to get that up. But from a Victorian perspective, we know that because we're spending money on supporting families with children with developmental delay, that many of them may not ever need to engage with the service system further down their journey. There's also the issue of non-Australian citizens. In Victoria, anyone is eligible for early childhood intervention. But under the NDIS, if you're not an Australian resident, you're not eligible for the NDIS. So that's a huge concern for us, because in many of our current early intervention services, we know that maybe 20 to 50% in some communities will be people on visas. And what will we do about them? What residual service will need to exist? I think we need to continue to advocate to make sure that we don't have a two-tiered residual service system, but rather that everyone can be eligible for those services. But it's important that we think about our advocacy on that. And also, I think for us, in our success in getting developmental delay included in the NDIS, we also have come up with the challenges of the word disability in the title of the National Disability Insurance Agency. Before, we were a service that sat in early childhood education and care. So for our families, they never knew that they were receiving a disability service. So to then expect them to want to engage with a system that's labelled disability is an incredibly challenging time for us, when we know that these services can make a difference in these families' lives. So we've done a bit of work through the referral pathways and through some of the things we've done on entry points to make that a little bit easier. So we've got this referral form. You can't see it. It's really tiny, but it's just to illustrate that a form exists. And in that, which is often enough to know that someone's thought about it and it exists, we've got a separate email address for anyone with early that requires early intervention. So the word disability for those families is not included in the email address that they're engaging with the system. They're also establishing a separate phone line for early intervention that'll be answered early childhood intervention rather than NDIS. So it's just about how can we develop more of those soft entry points into the system to support families. I know that while at times they may seem tokenistic, it's actually a big win for us to get to those points as well. I think in Victoria we've been very lucky with our central intake, and this has actually enabled us to make sure that not many people miss out on early childhood intervention, other than the fact that they may be sitting on a waiting list for 2 years. But if we put that to the side and the possibility that the NDIS has brought us in Barwon of no waiting list, it means that we can actually engage people better in the system and get to them early, which not only has a health and wellbeing imperative, but also has an economic outcome as well. So we've been working really hard to engage maternal and child health, paediatricians, early childhood education and care, and GPs, for example, into the process so they're aware of how to engage families. And while these lessons may be particularly focused on early intervention, they're certainly lessons that I think are applicable across the age spectrum. I think in terms of your role as advocates, there's a real need for providers to, for people to support families and people with disability in negotiating the process of the NDIS. It's a pretty complicated system when you think about it. And it's very simple on one hand. It's a one-stop shop in a sense, but to get to that point of engagement is also a pretty big challenge. We've had a challenge with our providers. We run a key worker model in early intervention. So most our current families all have one person that really goes with them on their journey. Now that's probably the one person that they would want with them in the room when they're developing their plan for the NDIS. But they're also going to be the person that they will purchase their service from, and they may not wish to purchase from that provider. So it's about how do we make that balance between supporting families on the journey, but also giving them the right to have independent representation and make a decision if they want to change service providers. I think in our current system, people have just been so grateful to get a service, particularly from early childhood, that they've never had felt confidence to change services a lot of the time, and they've been stuck with a provider that may not be able to meet their needs. So this provides us with the opportunity to really make sure that people are having genuine choice and control. And that's why it's really important to have independent advocacy. The Association for Children with a Disability, who we're also co-located with, have been doing a lot of work down in Barwon, for example, on engaging people and supporting families through the process. And by running the family sessions that we've been doing, and also the Confident and Connected Carers sessions that ACD and Carers Victoria have been running, it's been about providing people with the resources and information to help navigate a system. Because we don't want people to miss out. And we know that when things like this come up, where it is based on individual amounts of money, we don't want a system that ends up with the more articulate you are, the more service that you get. You know, we know that some people will have the means and the information to have been to a number of specialists, to have spent a lot of time with Dr. Google and bringing with them a whole lot of information. And so they're there prepared in that conversation. For those families that may not have the access to those resources, we need to make sure that they don't miss out simply because they didn't fit that kind of typical white middle class, well-resourced kind of group in society. That's why we need to make sure that advocates, independent advocacy organisations are out there and that you're providing the information like you do already so that people know what's available, what they're entitled to and how they can advocate for that. It's also, I think, in young children we face the challenge of people think the more service they get, the better it's going to be, when really we know it's about quality service, not volume of service. So I think that presents another challenge. When I hear of families that of school-aged children that may get plans that include 8 hours of therapy a week, I think, when is that therapy going to occur? And how do we help create that balance in families and children's lives? I think the market presents challenges around quality and safeguards, and the unintended consequences of the market. My background's in early childhood, so I lived through ABC childcare. And what happened with that when we put long daycare provision out to a market, and we saw a really significant impact on quality and sustainability. So we need to make sure that services are safe, they're high quality and they're best practice. Currently in Barwon, providers are having to meet the current DHS standards that exist, and that's really good. For us in early intervention, we have no standards. So early childhood intervention providers aren't required to meet any quality or accreditation systems. So for us, we're working very hard to make sure that we can get relevant standards for across jurisdictions for early childhood that are based on best practice evidence. We also face the challenge of governments wanting to reduce red tape while at the same time for providers, while at the same time ensuring safe and quality services. And I think there's some big challenges for us. And it's about who develops the standards and how relevant they are. And for us, we're working hard to make sure our members don't just have to meet the disability standards, because many of those standards are not very relevant for an early childhood learning and development service. So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of conversations to be had and a lot of advocacy to be done. It's also about making sure that accreditation is not just a number on a page and that it actually has teeth, because we know that while people may fail quality systems, they may never ever cease to exist. So we need to make sure there's robust mechanisms. One of the other things that is a challenge that I would put out to all of you is the role of engaging in critical conversations and our collective role in shaping the NDIS rollout. I think it's really about the importance of having a voice and influencing people. I think in the beginning, we were all kind of dazzled by the prospect of choice and control, that we never really engaged in a critical conversation about what that might look like for people with disability, but also for those people within our community who are experiencing the most disadvantage. We never thought to question what choice and control really looked like. So I don't want that, you know, the prospect of choice and control to impede our conversations in being able to engage in the critical conversations about the reality of a market and the impact of what a market will have on consumers. So that's kind of the challenge I put out to all of you, is how can we engage in those conversations and continue to make sure that we're not just lured by the bells and whistles of choice and control, but rather that we are able to engage in conversations that make sure genuine choice and control is actually on the table. I think also NDIS readiness is really important. I think, and that's the final point I want to leave you with today, it's really about how are you ready as advocacy organisations for the NDIS, and how are you getting ready? And also about how you're getting the people that you support ready for the NDIS as well. We don't want to overwhelm people and organisations with what the situation looks like now. Sarah and I get calls every day from providers across Victoria asking us, you know, what does it look like now? What do I need to do? That's the beauty of a trial, is that it's going to look very different. But you can still be engaging in some of that readiness work. You can be thinking and having conversations, and that's, I think, a lesson that we learnt from the trial sites, is we didn't have the time to prepare our clients for what it is. So, example in early intervention, one of our clients said, well, I don't need to worry about the NDIS because you'll just keep delivering me service. Or when people go in for their planning, there's an assumption that many of the things they receive, they'll continue to receive, so they don't talk about what their needs are. So we really need in the next few years to spend time talking to people about the things that they receive, the things that they need, and how we need to make sure that we remember those things as we move to the NDIS. It's also about empowering clients to be participants in a market. They will have the control, and that's incredibly exciting. I said to my providers the other day, I said, early childhood intervention won't look 9 to 5 anymore. And a whole heap of them said to me, well, I'm not going to work on the weekend. And I said, well, maybe early intervention isn't where you want to be, because this is about responding to families and responding to consumers and service providers. We need to get better at thinking about how we provide services to families and to people with disability in the context of which they're spending their time and the way that they're living their lives. So it's a big workforce challenge, an economic challenge for providers, but it's also a right of consumers to really have control of the market as well. And that's the value of us all working collaboratively. So this is us at Early Childhood Intervention Australia. It's really important that we continue to have these conversations, and I'm excited at the possibility of us continuing to work together and us all really playing a role in the change, because that's important. We really need to come together because we can shape this now, and that's what's truly exciting about being advocates at this time.
Thank you, Lauren. What a fabulous call to action from Lauren. I'm aware that we're eating into lunchtime, but I'm sure there are a few questions that you have of either Lauren or Sarah. Can you raise your hand if you do have a question? And when you do get the microphone, can you just say your name and the organisation that you're from?
Martin's Butcher from Dale. My question is more to Lauren. I will congratulate you on and we have an intervention team to gain where you had to. My issue is that it seems that if you're diagnosed before 7, you get access to this. When you turn 7, you are all stopped. So I know of a family that got their child got diagnosed at three, were able to get a lot of interventions in place, were able to go to specific preschool. That child now in year one and very well integrated. Other families that get diagnosed prep or year one, but only give them a year to do that. Almost need to be early intervention from the time they are diagnosed.
Yeah, and we've certainly been, can you hear me?
Yeah.
We've certainly been thinking about that because we know that currently in Victoria we support families in early childhood intervention. We give them these holistic services, we connect them to universal settings, and then it all just falls away. And families are left on their own a lot of the time. And if they get their diagnosis later on, then there's really not many services they can connect with at all. In relation to the NDIS, that's been a really big concern for us about what that means. One of the exciting things is that the NDIS, in working with people and determining eligibility, is looking at functioning. So we know many of our kids don't have a diagnosis, so by basing some of the assessments on functionality, we're actually able to broaden some of that eligibility, which I think is really exciting for us. I think what was really excited me was that we got a plan for an early intervention package for someone who was 12. And that was so exciting for me that we could have the possibility of that wraparound service for young children. And we're seeing in Barwon that this is the first time that school-aged children have ever been able to access a lot of supports and services. So in talking to those families there, it's kind of such an exciting time for them and for my providers who are now delivering school-aged service, so we can deliver that wraparound service from the point of engagement through as they transition through their childhood. But I think it's a really big issue, particularly for those children with developmental delay, in we get them into a system and then how do we help them transition out. So it's certainly at the front of all of our minds in how we work with that.
Thanks, Lauren. Anyone else with a question? Ty will bring the microphone to you.
Yeah, hi. It's...
Is it on?
Thank you. Is it on? Yeah, okay. Lovely. It's Jan from MEDA, Melbourne East Disability Advocacy. Sarah, just a question in relation to this notion of NDIS readiness. Is there something or a scope of things that you would suggest that the advocacy organisations and sectors could do as part of readiness?
I think following on from really what Lauren was saying about some of those conversations, having the conversations, and some of it is about, I mean, we tic-tac before coming, but I decided to just go over some of those NDIS basics. And even though I'm aware many people are quite familiar with that, but I just think in our conversations, in all our conversations, it's good not to assume knowledge, you know, that always going back to what's happening with what it is, why we've got NDIS, and sharing that information and then having some of those conversations that Lauren was talking about. Talking to people about... supporting them to be thinking about what their needs, their aspirations are, and there's going to be that opportunity to not just think, well, I've always had this level array of supports, that's what I want to hold on to, but think... Oh, Francis, you should... Oh, is that... Hang on. Is that better?
Yeah, sorry.
Apologies. All this technology. So I think it's... Yeah, I was just saying, having conversations, keeping the... in line of what Lauren was saying, about NDIS and about what people's aspirations are, and thinking and listening out for what there might be aspirations beyond what people have had to date, and thinking about services that might be beyond and not even offered at the moment, but that could be what they want.
And it's also about, I think, in terms of the advocacy space, we need to continue to maintain vigilant advocacy to make sure that independent advocacy is funded in this kind of new world order. Because the moment we lose independent advocacy or the resources for people to be self-advocacy, that's when the system will also fall in a hole. So we need to be strong in our advocacy to all levels of government, that they need to continue to invest in the services that you're all delivering.
Yep, Fiona from Grampians.
Yeah, Jibing from Grampians Disability Advocacy. My question is actually to do with, Lauren, you talked about vulnerable people falling through the cracks, families. I didn't hear anything mentioned about the Indigenous families because I am aware that a 10-point plan was received some funding. That's the last I heard about it, so I'm wondering if a working party was formed and if something's happening to engage the Indigenous community and acknowledge. It was developed in acknowledgement that there was significant trauma in, suffered from families in accessing such services, and they were very likely to fall through the cracks. So,
We've started some work as an organisation ourselves in engaging with the likes of VACCHO and the community health and Aboriginal cooperatives on the ground in Barwon to talk about how we can improve entry points, and also what might be the most appropriate way to deliver service to Indigenous families, because we know that that's a huge issue, and we know that that's an issue for us statewide, not just in a launch site. So really connecting how we're connecting departments, how we're using the resources more efficiently to actually meet people where they are so that we can provide a service that's not only high quality but also culturally competent. So it's a huge issue, and I know that a number of my members and Sarah's members are actively working in communities to try to address some of those really big issues.
And if I could just add that, as well as doing a bit of work in Barwon, NDS is working closely with the agency and with our services in the Northern Territory, and that's particularly looking at the more remote communities. But there's a whole array of challenges, not just the basic logistical and climate ones, but the cultural and, you know, understanding. Just the whole different worldviews, really, between a federal government, you know, system and the way people live. There's already been some bit of work, and it's really good that one of the trials is in this remote Indigenous community, because they're surely going to have a lot of challenges they're going to have to sort out, and hopefully the lessons from that we can then apply in all the other areas for the rollout.
Hi. My name is Andrew Rose from Nero. I've got a son who's 5, and he'll be starting school next year. At the moment, he's not with me, but I've got vision rights on the weekends. I had him last weekend, and I'm not sure how I can support him when I only got him about 3 days from, what was it, 4 to 4:30 on Sundays.
We've certainly had that as a challenge in the planning process, in how to engage the different custodial parents in the NDIA planning process. And they're actually working really hard to make sure that all views that surround a child can actually really be engaged in that, in the planning process, so that everyone actually has a role. I think that's a really big challenge that we face, because then it's also, though, about how our system is engaging with family service organisations, with non-custodial parents, with foster carers, with grandparents, and how everyone is actually part of that journey and part of the responsibility of the success of the plan. But it's certainly a big challenge that is coming up in Barwon, and the NDIA is acutely aware of it and really doing some interesting work in trying to think how to really do some of that.
Thanks, Lauren. We'll end there. If anyone else has any more questions, I know Sarah is staying on for lunch, and Lauren, are you staying on? Fabulous. So both Sarah and Lauren will be here during lunch, so commandeer them if you do need to if you have a burning question. Before I let you go to lunch, I was reminded when Lauren was speaking, especially when you spoke, Lauren, about self-referral. I sit on the Victorian Disability Advisory Council, and at our last meeting we had a presentation from the father of a 12-year-old child with multiple physical disabilities, and he said he was unclear and unsure about what they might ask for in terms of the planning for her package, and he really praised the efforts of the planner that
he and his family were allocated to. And for, he made the specific example of they didn't think to ask for the cost of his daughter's incontinence pads to be covered under the package. So by having a planner who was, who had a strong background in delivery of disability services and really wanted to support the family, he was actually prompted to ask for what he needed. So your point about self-referral and you know, making sure that not just the loudest voices and the most articulate voices get heard, I think is really poignant.